Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Paul Haddad on the show. Paul is the author of several books about his native Los Angeles, including the critically lauded LA Times bestseller, Inventing Paradise, The Power Brokers Who Created the Dream of Los Angeles. Also, Freewaytopia, How Freeways Shape Los Angeles, 10,000 Steps a Day in LA, 57 Walking Adventures, and High Fives, Pennant Drives, and Fernando Mania, a fan's history of the Los Angeles Dodgers glory years, 1977 to 1981. As a writer and contributor, his work has appeared in such media outlets as the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post, the Times of London, the LAist, ESPN, NPR, and Huffington Post. He is also the author of three novels. An MFA graduate of USC's School of Cinematic Arts, Haddad has been nominated for multiple Emmys as a documentary producer. I had so much fun talking to Paul about all things Los Angeles. I hope you enjoy our conversation. To start, Paul, what do you think Los Angeles's posture toward its own history is these days?
I think Los Angeles is embracing a lot of its history. When I was growing up, the city was always being compared to San Francisco or New York, and it felt like a second-class citizen as cities go. But that all started changing with the 1984 Olympics, and because it's become more of a Pacific Rim hub, a melting pot, has a big international port for trade, great restaurants. I think it's lost that stigma of being an inferior stepchild to some of these other cities. But having said that, there are always people who feel that Los Angeles, especially with the homeless epidemic now, that it's ugly or not pretty. That was something I was reading about recently as people are trying to figure out what the city should do for the 2028 Olympics. And it was described as just an unsightly city as you drive through it. So there's always been people who feel that the city should be doing better and not matching up with Paris, for example, which just hosted the Olympics. I think a lot of people living in different cities are their own worst enemy, and I have a self-loathing complex, and I think that's never going to go away.
Okay. And in terms of Hollywood's role in telling, because Hollywood is always telling the story of Los Angeles, which there's a lot of myth making that goes on and which complicates our ability to truly understand. How would you think about the costs and benefits of having such a large filmmaking industry in a town and thinking about how to tell the story of that town? I know it's a complicated question, but I'm just trying to think of Hollywood's role in how we think about the history of LA.
Hollywood played a big part in the growth of Los Angeles because that was an industry when it started in the 19-teens in Los Angeles that was still in its nascent years. And Harry Chandler, one of the protagonists of my book.
We're going to talk about him extensively here. Yeah, I can't wait to get to that.
Yeah, he was instrumental in really getting the film industry established in LA to the point where in the 1920s, Los Angeles was producing 3/4 of the films around the world. And so you really have to look at Hollywood, the film industry, as being very important to the success of Los Angeles. And the Hollywood film industry even factored into the 1932 Olympics in that it helped shape the Olympics in a way that was palatable for audiences at that time. It established some rituals that we now take for granted, largely because of cinematographers, producers, directors who had creative input in how the Olympics would be presented in 1932. For example, it was the first Olympic village that was established in 1932, and now we take that for granted. The tiered podiums for the first, second, and third place winners, that was something first done in LA. Photo finishes, because we had really good filmmakers, they decided to implement some techniques where you can actually take a picture of who won a race by hair. And there are all these kind of unprecedented rituals at that time that we now take for granted, that you can look to the Hollywood film industry as contributing to the Olympics, to certainly LA's industry growth, history. It's very important to the success of LA.
Let's say for a minute, hypothetically, you could erase all the lines that demarcate Los Angeles as a city, and you are tasked with redrawing the lines according to some kind of rubric, whether that's cultural alignment, natural landscape formation, something along that. How would you think about defining LA? Is there something that can, in other words, I'm asking, like, how is LA connected to each other? I go to different neighborhoods. If I go to Santa Monica and I go to somewhere near Highland Park, you feel like you're in two very different cities. But so for you, like, how would you think about redrawing those lines?
There's that old saying about Los Angeles that there is no there. It's not a traditional city where everything spokes out from downtown, from a central business district. Los Angeles is made up of 88 communities within LA County, and within Los Angeles itself, there's these little isolated cities like Culver City, Beverly Hills, West Hollywood. So really, I think Los Angeles is what you make of it. And the way I would define it is a series of communities that for people who live there, they call it home and they feel like they're at home. And it may be vastly different from another part of LA that's in the valley. If you're in Sylmar, you're certainly not in Highland Park. You're not in Playa del Rey. They're all so unique from one another that you really have to fall in love with the particular style of living you want and find your hood, find your area where you feel most at home. And that is what Los Angeles is to most of the people who live here.
Okay. Is there anything that makes LA about the natural landscape? If I'm thinking about how cities develop, they say geography is destiny. I would say topography is also kind of part of destiny. Is there something topographical or in terms of the natural landscape that makes LA unique?
Yes. The one reason that it developed to this megalopolis like it is because of the inherent climate. It is a Mediterranean climate. That's a very rare climate in the world. If you look at all the big cities in the world, it's a little sliver of cities, many of them very well known, certainly Paris or parts of Italy, South Africa, parts of Australia, Chile, Los Angeles. There's just a few that just fall along the correct latitude that allows for ocean breezes, cool nights, days that don't get too hot, that are dry, not too humid. And all that lends itself to good health. A lot of people moved here when they had, in the 1800s, tuberculosis or other respiratory diseases, and they would come here to restore their health. And it went beyond that. You can grow really all types of things here, different produce, which also put LA on the map because the produce was a big industry that you could then send around the world and get people to come out to want to experience it themselves. This kind of like good living, good clean living, good air, not crowded like other old cities. And so the way the topography is laid out, you have the ocean breezes that can go as far inland as Dodger Stadium or beyond in contemporary LA. And then the valley is, of course, another part of Los Angeles. It's much hotter, but it was the first vast suburb in the United States when it was annexed to the city in 1916. And it also promised the American dream that you could own a house and live in it in the 20s independently in your car. Cars were the easiest way to get around the valley because it was so vast. So because it's so spread out, and Los Angeles is about almost 500 square miles, it lent itself to just freedom and free living. Cars were necessary to get around starting from the 20s. So it really redefined what an American city is.
Fantastic. Let's jump into freeways, which is something that is both the bane of people's existence, but also makes our society function. Just a general question to start. Do you think some of these super complicated freeway interchanges that we have in Los Angeles are beautiful?
I do. I think aesthetically, that's been proven. They graced postcards. The first four-level interchange, which is downtown, built in the 50s, that was the first in the world. And I love the old postcards. You can find them on eBay very easily that are aerial shots of all of our cloverleaf interchanges, particularly the four-level in downtown Los Angeles. And they had these headlines over the picture that would say, dig those LA freeways, man, and things like that, that were glorifying just the engineering aspect of freeways. There were artists from around the world who really appreciated the four level. And one of them actually compared it to what it would have been like for someone to first lay eyes on the cathedrals of Europe. And in terms of just the majesty of it all and just the awe that they inspire. And there is a certain form and function aesthetic that is inherent, I think, in a lot of freeway interchanges.
Which freeway would you least like to be on at 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon?
Wow, pick your poison with that one.
Yeah. Most people, I feel, would say the 405.
I'd
For
have to
me,
say the.
I lived in Pasadena for a long time, so I would say the 210 going east would be my nightmare. But for you, what is it?
It's the 405. The
Yeah.
405, the 405 is the freeway everyone loves to hate, and it's the freeway associated with the phrase Carmageddon, even though that
Yes.
was created by Caltrans to explain why there would be traffic when they widened the freeway. They came up with Carmageddon, but that actually applies to the freeway in general, that term, because it's crowded almost any time of day. And certainly there are trouble spots that are always congested where the 405 hits the 10, the 134 and the 405 is another horrible bottleneck all the time. It's a poorly engineered interchange, by the way. It's very dated. It's one reason it is crowded all the time. But in terms of mass of cars, the volume of cars going through any particular freeway interchange, the 405 and the 134 has about 500,000 a day. So it's always going to be crowded. Same with the East LA interchange just southeast of downtown. That also has 500,000 cars a day and is perpetually congested.
Let's talk about the Arroyo Seco freeway, which I, when my wife and I lived in Pasadena, I referred to it as the Mario Kart track because I felt like I was playing a video game because it's so tight. I was always nervous when I was driving on it because I felt like I was just going to bump into the person next to me. And obviously, it was designed for a different era. So, a couple things about it. Can you discuss how the natural landscape made this a good choice for the location of the first freeway, and maybe add in some discussion about the drainage advantages as well?
Yeah, the freeway, the Arroyo Seco Parkway, which opened in 1940, it hugs the Arroyo Seco, which means in Spanish, dry river. And it's the kind of riverbed that goes from Pasadena to downtown LA. It was a natural right of way to build the parkway. And when the parkway was built, it was during the time that Robert Moses had been building parkways back east, which are proto early freeways in the northeast region of the country. But the Arroyo Seco took it one step further. It was really more like an actual modern freeway. It had more, as you described, it was a freeway in the sense that it had overpasses, it had a lot of embankments, cars could drive unimpeded without private property kind of obstructing any of the roadway. So there were no areas where the freeway started and stopped. It was just a continuous conveyance for fast speeds. It had higher speed limit. So it did have all those elements of a freeway, but it was still beautiful. It was designed during the City Beautiful movement, which was all about trying to make the urban environment as beautiful as possible for people and then make inspiring projects, especially during the WPA period and of the 30s. But the freeway is dated because it was built more not a standard freeway you'd find today, but more of a beautiful parkway.
Yeah. But what always made me nervous when I was driving on it was when I was in Highland Park seeing a friend, and I'd have to get on one of those like little on ramps where you're just like, it almost reminded me. A while back, I lived in Pomona next to the drag racing tracks out there. And it reminded me of that where I'd just like gun it as soon as I had an opening, and it just felt dangerous. Was
Yeah.
there, has there been movements to address some of the dangers and challenges over time with this particular parkway?
There have been implemental movements to try to improve the safety of the Arroyo Seco Parkway. There have been little turnouts created for cars that might be stalled or need to get over because there are no shoulders on that freeway.
Yeah.
That's another unusual dated aspect of it. There have been a lot of, you can't really reconfigure many of the off ramps or on ramps because there's no land to do that. They're just baked into the landscape. And there's, so for example, when you're driving 55 miles an hour and you need to exit, sometimes you have to make a sharp right turn and the speed limit goes down to 5 miles an hour. And conversely, to get on the freeway, as you mentioned, you're sitting at a stop sign, which is also rare to get on a freeway to actually have to be at a stop sign and then gun it to merge in with cars doing 60 miles an hour. But they have created a little more of a runway when you're trying to get on the freeway where there's a little more space to merge in with traffic. So little band-aids here and there. But by and large, my daughter, when she first drove on the freeway when she was 16, she described it as being very cute and almost like a driving, like you mentioned Mario Brothers, but she and I like to describe it as like the grandmother of all freeways. It's dainty. And so you have to take it at a slower speed because there are more curves because they wanted it to be a scenic parkway. And I think once you understand that when you drive it, it is very enjoyable to drive. It's not for everybody though, of course.
Okay. Let's talk about, bring Robert Moses into this. You already brought up his name, so we're going to bring him in and talk about displacement for a second. There's a lot of neighborhoods that were displaced and are experienced displacement because of freeway installation. I think of Sugar Hill or Boyle Heights. There's lots that come to mind. And I guess my question to you is, what do we understand about the actual impacts of the displacement here? I think there's maybe a bit of a contrast between what happened in New York and what happened in Los Angeles in terms of the age of the cities and infill and how impacted those. LA is a bit more sparsely populated if you, in terms of density compared to a place like New York. So what do we actually understand about the impacts that happened when those freeways were put in?
When you compare the parkways designed by Robert Moses in upstate New York, those mostly went through a lot of rural areas. And in Los Angeles, freeways displaced more urban neighborhoods. And what you had were areas that were near downtown Los Angeles that were highly populated, but were maybe lower income people living there who didn't have as much of a voice with City Hall. So it was easier to put freeways through their neighborhoods because they were more marginalized, and they also had there were cheaper land values there. So the right-of-way costs were far cheaper to build a freeway through poorer neighborhoods. And so that's why you have this congregation of a lot of freeways, especially in East Los Angeles, Boyle Heights, areas where the land was cheaper to acquire and there'd be less resistance from the people who live there. And when you look at LA's freeway system, you also have to look at where freeways were not built. And they were not built in a lot of areas on the west side. There was a Beverly Hills freeway. Good luck trying to get that built. That would have gone pretty much paralleling either Sunset Boulevard or Santa Monica Boulevard in the west side. Very expensive real estate. And the residents fought it tooth and nail and eventually got deleted from the legislative maps in the 1970s. And you could see this pattern arising all the time of freeways that also would have gone through the canyons of Los Angeles. Mulholland Drive would have been turned into a freeway, or Topanga Canyon would have turned into the Reseda or Malibu freeway. And all of those got nixed because people were just, at that point, by the 60s and 70s, were fed up with the fact that freeways were starting to displace a lot of people in neighborhoods. But the people in those aforementioned neighborhoods certainly had more money and they had more lobbyists to kill the freeways in those areas.
Yeah, you led me to my next question pretty naturally, which is asking you broadly if you think the era of freeways is coming to an end with the emergence of NEPA and CEQA and environmental impact reports. It's so complicated to build anything. And it seems like at this point, you know, the idea that you would displace someone for a freeway would just be absurd given the political situation in California. Do you think freeways have come to an end in terms of building new freeways? We're just entering a repair phase where it's just about maintenance and not expansion?
Yeah, what you described is exactly what Caltrans said recently when I've interviewed them for Freewaytopia, that we're not in the freeway building business anymore. We're in the freeway maintenance business. And so the last freeway that we'll probably certainly see in our lifetime and others as well was the Century Freeway, the 105, which completed in 1993. And even that one was a real chore to complete. It's only about 22 miles or so, but it took decades to get it done because of various lawsuits, environmental lawsuits, neighbors that were more empowered by the 80s who found a very sympathetic judge who also sued Caltrans and said, we don't want a freeway through Linwood or Watts or Willowbrook. And the judge shut down the freeway and demanded that Caltrans create job training centers and that they subcontract with companies that were run by minorities or women. And it became just too cost prohibitive for Caltrans to build freeways from that point on because they were being sued. There were overcosts with construction, overruns, and it ended up costing $2 billion when an issue is supposed to be $30 million or even less to build that freeway. So now it is efforts to try to alleviate congestion, whether that's congestion pricing on freeways, having more tolls to try to discourage people from taking the freeways. You certainly don't even see the widening of freeways anymore. I think Carmageddon put the kibosh on that when they widened the San Diego freeway in the 2010s, and it led to actually more traffic after $1 billion had been spent. Because when you widen freeways, it actually encourages more people to take to freeways. It's a latent demand, and so it induces more people to the roadways. And so, yeah, freeways are yesterday's technology in terms of transit, and we're trying to certainly get to more rail, other means of getting around town, building houses near transit centers and light rail stations. I think that's the future of LA.
Okay, last question on freeways. Aside from the 110 or the Arroyo Seco Parkway, what do you think is the most underrated freeway in terms of beauty in Los Angeles?
I don't know if it's underrated because people who take this freeway really appreciate its beauty, but the 2 freeway, the Glendale freeway, which ironically was going to be part of the Beverly Hills freeway. Santa Monica Boulevard is Highway 2. It actually has a little 2 insignia. It's a state highway that starts at the ocean and goes all the way to Sunset Boulevard and Silver Lake. And that was all going to be part of the Glendale Freeway. It's going to be the Beverly Hills Freeway, then connecting to the Glendale Freeway was the only portion built. That starts in Silver Lake and or Echo Park area, and it goes all the way to La Cañada Flint Ridge. And it goes through the San Rafael Hills and the Verdugo Mountains when you get north of the 134. It's very picturesque. It doesn't have much traffic. When you go south, you have this beautiful view of the downtown skyline. Last year in 2023, when we had those freak snowstorms in early 2023 that were in Los Angeles, the Glendale Freeway had snow along the shoulders. And that was something I'd never experienced in my lifetime, that you could actually be driving through, you know, just little flurries at that point, but beautiful snowfall in the San Gabriel Mountains there when you're driving north. It was stunning. People were pulling over and taking pictures of it, myself included. And then the other ironic thing about the Glendale Freeway, it stops in La Cañada Flint Ridge, but it was supposed to continue on as the Angeles Forest Freeway. Yet a third portion of the 2, Highway 2, that would have gone all the way to Victorville, cutting through the mountains and turning what's the beautiful Angeles Crest Highway as we know it today, it's a 2-lane road, would have been a 8-lane freeway or a 6-lane freeway, carving up the mountains.
I can hear the cashier sound in my head in terms of cost. I can't even imagine what that would cost to construct today.
Oh my God. The outcry just on that alone today. But there was a time that it actually got rubber stamped by a lot of departments in California. It made it pretty far through the legislative process before it finally got killed, that section.
Wow. Let's transition from cars to our feet for a second. You also wrote a fantastic book about places to walk around LA, which I think as an outsider, they might not assume that there's great places to just stroll around on foot in Los Angeles. But I can say as someone that's done a lot of that, that there's a lot of fantastic places. So let's imagine a friend from the East Coast emails you and says, I'm going to spend a day in Los Angeles. I want to take 2 nice walks, either on a trail or in the city. Where would you recommend?
2 nice walks. One of the more recent trails that has opened up is the Park to Playa Trail. And that is, I don't know if you've been on that yet, but that's the trail that it doesn't really start at Kenneth Hahn Park off La Cienega, but it starts just east of that in Crenshaw. And it's a newly opened trail that goes about, I think, 10 to 13 miles starting from Crenshaw Hills. And then it goes over La Cienega Park. And it cuts through what used to be a lot of oil derricks, the Inglewood oil field. And all of that has been repurposed into a little nature center there. There's new vegetation, a lot of restorative landscape. And the trail goes through all of that. And then it goes up to the Culver City Stairs, which a lot of people like to take up. It's a big Instagram place. And then the trail continues downhill toward Playa del Rey and takes you all the way to the beach. And so the last portion of it, if you're going west, goes along Bologna Creek, which also has a nice bikeway there. And what I like about that trail is it gives you a good cross-section of central Los Angeles up to the west side. It has great vantage points. You could see the snow on Mount Baldy during the winter. You can see the Hollywood sign. You can look and see the entire LA basin, the coastal plain, as they call it, as you're looking down at everything from downtown to Culver City to the west side. And then you end up in Bologna Creek, which is one of the original old areas of swampland in LA, some of which has been preserved. That's a good cross-section. That's a newer trail that a lot of people have discovered lately. As far as a second trail, I wouldn't say it's overrated. It's certainly overused, but it's a great place to people watch and to bring your dog, because you could take your dog off leash, and that would be Runyon Canyon.
Yeah, that's what I was literally going to ask you, if you thought Runyon Canyon was a bit overrated, because it feels like it's like a, if you want to see a celebrity, quote unquote, kind of thing. Like
that's correct.
So you go there just to watch people as opposed to just walk around. And so I wasn't sure if you thought it was overrated.
Overrated, but it serves its purpose. And it's popular for a reason. That's because you can see celebrities there. You can see people doing yoga. It's a very LA trail where it's just great to people watch and also experience nature and get a good workout in. And it also is one of those rare popular trails that takes you through the Santa Monica Mountains, which are a defining feature of LA. It's the mountain range that divides the coastal basin from the San Fernando Valley, and Runyon Canyon allows you to hike from the coastal basin up to the crest line of the Santa Monica Mountains, up to Mulholland Drive. And so for that reason, I think it's important, just for, geographically speaking, as a trail.
I'm glad you mentioned Mount Baldy a minute ago. I had a strange 9 months in which I lived in Laverne, and it happened to be a year where there was some snow on Mount Baldy. And I remember looking out of my apartment window at the snow on the top of that mountain. It's an incredible vista. There's so many underrated places, scenic places in Los Angeles. Now, in terms of city streets, do you think LA is a walkable city in terms of sidewalks and city streets, or do you think it has a long way to go to be a place where people can just stroll down an avenue?
This might sound scandalous, but I think it's one of the best walking cities in the world.
Oh, really? Okay. There's a lot of assumptions that it isn't. So what would you say in response to this?
Yeah, it's one reason I wrote my book, 10,000 Steps a Day in LA, 57 Walking Adventures, is because I wanted people to not be scared of walking in LA. I wanted to debunk the myth that LA is not a good walking city. Now, of course, there are sidewalks that are not great to walk on, or there's some areas of the city that are maybe a little dicey to walk through. But when we were talking about LA being just this melting pot of different communities. And so what I do with that book is divide LA up into five regions: West Side, Valley, Central LA, South Bay, et cetera, and find those little pockets, those little neighborhoods that have maybe the local bookstore and some good restaurants and good walking paths, maybe along the median of a main street or along the coast, or some of it goes through some hilly territory, but also ends up like in Los Feliz Village, for example, if you're walking through Griffith Park and then ending up in the Village. And I think when you carve out different walking itineraries, it's easy for me to find those neighborhoods that maybe are known to the people who live in those neighborhoods, but as someone who might live in Burbank, you may not be familiar with, I don't know, the Palisades and know how walkable it is, or another region. And so it's a chance to discover those neighborhoods that you might only pass on your freeway or just buzzing past them on your way to work, to really stop and smell the roses and realize, okay, this is a really walkable, great neighborhood with a lot of old time establishments there. Another example would be Magnolia Park in Burbank. It's this great funky area with lots of thrift stores and escape rooms and kooky retro stores and clothing stores and good restaurants with a real personality of its own. A really unique bookstore called Auto Books and Arrow Books that Jay Leno likes going in there because it's been there since the 50s, and it's an entire bookstore devoted to cars and planes. And books about those. Where else can you get that in the city? And so that's another nice little stretch there along Magnolia Boulevard. So I feel, given our climate and that you can walk pretty much every day of the year in the city, it really lends itself to walkability.
Okay. Last question on walking around LA. Let's say that you were going to host a history nerd like myself, and you wanted to design a walking tour that was less than 2 hours, where you could see as many kind of historical sites as possible. Where might you choose?
I think the obvious answer would be downtown, just because that was the birthplace of LA. We're talking like the Broadway district and all the other streets that spoke out of that. I would certainly do some kind of route that involves Los Angeles just south of the Civic Center, and then going north just beyond the 101 freeway up to Chinatown and Alvera Street, because that's the other old sections of LA. Maybe throw a little Tokyo in there as well. It's just a wealth of old historic landmarks, some not so great. Union Station's beautiful. You get to experience that, but it also displaced the original Chinatown. And then Alvera Street was not really where LA originally started. That wasn't really the origin, that particular street. That was created in 1930 as a way to romanticize the Mexican and Spanish cultures. So that says something about LA also. Yet you are very close to where Los Angeles started, and there are historic sections and buildings in that area near Alvera Street that are worth checking out. So I think it has to start with that kind of 2-square-mile region that starts from the Civic Center up and the Broadway District up north to Chinatown and Alvera Street.
Fantastic. Let's get to your new book, which I am absolutely loving so much. And reading about Harry Chandler is obviously fascinating. His life spans such an amazing amount of time. He's born in the last 2 years of the Civil War, and then he dies just as the Allies are winning World War II. So he spans these like epochs of like time that are so different from each other, and so much has happened, and he had such an outsized impact. We could probably spend a full hour just going through his detailed biography, but can you give it a brief sketch? And then I have some specific questions for you about him.
Yeah, Harry Chandler was part of the Gilded Age. He was the Gilded Era. He was born in the 1800s, like pretty much everybody in my book who I discuss who helped build Los Angeles. And that you have to understand the Gilded Era to understand someone like Harry Chandler, because it was a time period when Americans, especially after the Civil War, thought that they could accomplish anything. And it was a time period of unregulated taxation and unregulated wealth. It was when the Rockefellers and Carnegies made their money. It was all about man conquering nature, that nothing was impossible. And there was a lot of hubris with the men who helped build many of the industries, these titans of industries in the United States in general. And then in Los Angeles, what you had with Harry Chandler was somebody who had moved to LA because he thought he was going to die. He had really bad respiratory illness and moved out here, and eventually not only got better, but was able to succeed because it was a town that loved people like Harry Chandler that were risk takers. And that's another thing all the titans of industry have in common in my book. They were risk takers who were often rewarded for breaking, kind of not breaking the law, but breaking the norms and not being afraid to take chances and pissing a lot of people off, because that was a sign of power and machismo. And you needed these kind of like big thinkers and visionaries to grow the city in a way that proved that they were fearless. And that's the first thing I'd say about Harry Chandler, was he was an unassuming man. When you looked at him, he looked like a college professor. He was a fundamentalist. He was a Bible-living guy. Who was very religious and didn't have many vices, but he was also a shark when it came to capitalism. He was an entrepreneur. He didn't just run the Los Angeles Times, he was the largest landowner in the United States at one point. He was an interesting guy.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit of his anti-union stances. I think it's complicated. I've read some other stuff about him that it was an inheritance from his father-in-law, his predecessor. But then I also understand that he was there when the bombing happened, didn't take it over to the LA Times. Can you briefly talk about the bombing and whether you think that is what created a lot of his politics, or do you think that was something that he was carrying on from his family?
Well, Harry Chandler learned a lot from his father-in-law, who, as you mentioned, was the original publisher of the LA Times, and that was General Harrison Gray Otis. And Harrison Gray Otis ran the LA Times in the 1880s, pretty much to his death in 1917. But there was an overlap there, I'd say from 1905 onward, where Harry Chandler was running a lot of the Times himself. He'd worked his way up the ranks, and he learned to be anti-union from his father-in-law. And Chandler carried that stance till his dying days. He would tell his younger charges in the 30s, when they were trying to make the paper more, I don't know, a little more progressive. And he would shoot down any kind of editorial edicts to make it more even keeled, the paper. He would say, look, there's only one way to carry a union story, and that's the Times way. So it was, they've definitely villainized all these labor groups, because according to Otis and Chandler, labor organizers got in the way of LA's growth. It was stifling growth because workers were being paid more. There was more taxation. It flew in the face of this place that they thought should be like retaining its Wild West roots, where anything goes and wasn't impeding progress, and that things should be quote unquote free, like a free harbor that wasn't run by longshoremen who had a union, as they did in San Francisco. LA was a place of freedom where you were free from all those regulations, and that led to more growth. And that was something that also led, as you mentioned, also the bombing of the LA Times building in 1910. That was a result of unionists getting fed up with the Times not having a more pro-union stance. And unfortunately, the LA Times building in downtown was dynamited by two union brothers and ended up killing 24 people. I don't think they intended to kill anyone, really. It was at night, but it actually, there were a lot of people working there, and where they set the bombs off was next to some very flammable fluids. It was called Ink Alley, or the back alley where they planted the bombs, and it acted as an igniter or an accelerant. And so it did a lot of damage. A lot of people were killed. And that just solidified the idea that unions are bad. And as I mentioned in my book, the Times for generations did not allow for a unionized newsroom up until 2019. And they were one of those, that's a long stretch there of over 100 years where the newspaper did not want workers to organize.
One of my favorite movies of all time is Chinatown. It always will be. It always has been. And the story of the LA Aqueduct and the story of water in Los Angeles is a fascinating one. Can you talk about a little bit how Harry Chandler got involved in the LA Aqueduct project? And do you think that the way his paper overlooked some of the challenges of Owens Valley was unusual in terms of propaganda back then, or was that pretty normative for newspapers to be slanted towards their publishers' proclivities or vested interests? Because I've seen a lot of criticism that the newspaper ignored the plight of the people in Owens Valley. And I just thought in my head, I was like, that's pretty typical for this period in terms of how newspapers cover topics.
Certainly Los Angeles, it was typical because Los Angeles had many newspapers then. And a couple of them were run by William Randolph Hearst, who everyone knows was the inspiration for Citizen Kane, the character played by Orson Welles. But the Times was, again, anti-unionist and pro-growth. And the Hearst papers were for the working man. So they would certainly skew their stories toward a more populist views. And the LA Times was not afraid to just spread misinformation and lies in order to grow the city. And so Chandler and the Times in the early 1900s definitely pushed the idea that Los Angeles would never get to be a global city if it could not grow its population. And the way to do that was to build an aqueduct from Owens Valley up in Northern California all the way down to Los Angeles, which would enable the city to accommodate up to 3 million people. Because with just the Los Angeles River as the water source, the most you could have would be about 200,000 people. So the Times went out of its way to, first of all, to say that it was the right of Los Angeles to have access to the river. And they did this by spinning this idea that the Owens River used to be part of the LA River back in time, which was to me an eye-opening declaration when I was researching my book, that it was just a God-ordained idea that that Los Angeles deserved to have the river and the water taken away from the farmers in Owens Valley because it connected to the LA River as recently as 1,000 years ago. And they used no geologists or hydrologists or engineers to back up their story. It was just made up out of whole cloth. And there were a lot of nameless quotes never attributed to actual sources. It was just made up by the LA Times writers to peddle this idea that was rightfully LA's water. And that what happened in the intervening years was there was a series of earthquakes that unleashed boulders that blocked the water from Owens River down to the LA River. And if you look at the topography of California, there's no way they were connected. The water would have to go uphill in a series of places. And so everyone bought into this idea that it was just correcting nature's mistake to have the water come down here. And the public bought it. And so you got definitely one-sided viewpoints that the water deserved to come to LA.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about another one of these famous founders. And we're going to talk for a second about ghosts, things that were once central parts of LA but have gone away. And for me, that's the Pacific Electric Railway, is this kind of ghost. When I've read about it, I try to picture it and imagine it in my mind, and it's hard to fathom just this extensive electric railway network. Can you describe what it was and how it was created?
Yeah, the Pacific Electric Railway was a streetcar system in Los Angeles that existed at its peak. It had 1,100 miles of railway across the Southland. And most of it was built by Henry Huntington, another protagonist in my book, but he inherited a lot of the lines from Moses Sherman, another guy I focus on, and other kind of railway barons who either went bankrupt or they sold their railway lines to Henry Huntington. So Huntington either built or acquired this empire where you could get around anywhere in LA pretty much through a red car trolley or a yellow car. The yellow cars were separate from the Pacific Electric system. The yellow cars were the intra-city cars, streetcars, in which you can get from one neighborhood to the next. the red car system, the Pacific Electric, could take you from one region to another region across town. And it, of course, it was a privately run system. People forget that. They think it was run by the city and, oh, we all missed the red car. And why did we have to tear them up? It was originally a privately run a streetcar line that also, when it was built, Henry Huntington and these other streetcar owners, they wanted to build lines to subdivisions that they built. So the lines essentially were taking you to suburbs where they would make even more money because they had built all these houses that they wanted you to live in. So the lines were a means to an end. And the Pacific Electric cars were often lost leaders. They often lost money every year, but Huntington didn't care because he made a killing on all the houses he built that the lines took you to. And then he could sell you utilities through his electric and gas companies. So the lines were very convenient for people to get around, but they ultimately went away because they started deteriorating. Huntington lost interest. He sold some of them off. And LA was growing to such an extent that you couldn't run streetcars up into, I don't know, Beverly Hills, the hills of the Hollywood Hills or Woodland Hills or way out in the valley. And that's when cars started taking over and buses could go to places where Pacific Electric cars, streetcars could not go. So
can I interrupt you real quick? Based on your description, it sounds like you don't put a lot of stock in this kind of General Motors streetcar conspiracy that I was reading about, this idea that automotive companies were conspiring to get rid of streetcars so it was not competition with automobiles. Do you believe that in any capacity, or do you think that's just a post-fact? The rise of cars corresponds with the decline of streetcars, and there must be someone behind twisting their mustache and hatching a plan.
Yeah, more of the latter. And okay. It wasn't an overt conspiracy. However, there certainly were some shady things going on where I believe it was National Tires and General Motors, some consortium of those, as you mentioned, bought the kind of aging streetcar line. And they wanted to create buses rather than have trains take people around. And so they had some influence in the lines being ripped up. However, the ridership had been declining every year, especially since World War II. And people in general didn't want them anymore because they were getting in the way of increasingly congested streets. And as I mentioned, they were not going to places that everyone wanted to go. So there was a movement away from streetcars and more toward automobiles, and especially with more suburbs opening up around LA. So they were just following what the public patterns at that time.
For you personally, how has writing Inventing Paradise changed your perspective on the history of LA? For you personally?
That's a good question. I think what it made me realize is one reason I wrote the book, and this was a big impetus to write the book, was it made me realize that the power in Los Angeles was really consolidated amongst a handful of real movers and shakers. It's almost similar to when you look at a John Ford movie, a Western, and power is controlled by the sheriff and his underlings, and maybe there's a crooked mayor. It wasn't that far removed from that early Los Angeles. And LA was just like, it was called the hellhole of the West in the mid 1800s. It only had 5,000 people. And it was a place that really was a frontier town controlled by just a small number of people who had outsized influence. And when this patriarchy started dictating how the city would grow, they had a lot of power at a time when other cities around the U.S. maybe did not. And so I think that was the most revealing thing to me as I was embarking on my research, was how much of the city's growth really could be traced back to this kind of gang of six, as I call them, who I focus on in my book. And under them were, of course, other people who exerted a lot of influence, but it started from these six folks.
Okay, a couple of general questions about California now to close. What's the strongest case for centering LA as the most important city in California as opposed to San Francisco?
The Port of Los Angeles, I would start with that. The Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach are the two busiest ports in the entire United States, which is interesting that it is, because they're not natural ports. They're not natural harbors. They're man-made. It was a way when they were constructed, and when by that it was a place where they the government, the federal government, put a lot of money into dredging the harbors to make it navigable for deep ships. So that started international trade with Los Angeles. And certainly by 1914, when the Panama Canal opened, Los Angeles was a more convenient port for ships coming north because it was the first stop over San Francisco. And because San Francisco Harbor is a natural harbor, it wasn't as conducive to ships coming in to the harbor because it wasn't man-made or manufactured in such a way that could benefit ships. That was another selling point for LA Harbor when people like Otis and Chandler were selling the LA Harbor to the public and to try to get money to dredge it. The other reason that LA Harbor is superior to San Francisco Harbor is because it lies at a more southerly latitude, which means when ships come in with their freight and if they want to deliver it to the rest of the U.S., they're taking southern-bound trains, which don't go through snow. They go through desert. The weather usually is good enough year-round to ship your goods. In San Francisco, if ships are coming in, they have to, if they load the freight on trains, they have to go through the Rocky Mountains. We've got to go through Donner Pass or other areas directly east that might have snow. That was another selling point for Los Angeles over San Francisco. And so these were selling points that were rooted years ago when they built them, and they've held up because LA Harbor just keeps growing.
And I already asked this about LA, and specifically when I asked you about how it's changed, writing Inventing Paradise has changed your perspective of LA. How did writing Inventing Paradise, along with your other books, change your perspective on the state of California?
I guess, to me, what they reinforced was my idea that California is usually at the cutting edge of a lot of movements. California is a microcosm for what eventually transpires in the United States. Many of the progressive programs or areas of transit like freeways took root here and then eventually evolved elsewhere. So if you want to get an idea of what the rest of the United States might look like, it starts with California. And even just like the kind of forward thinking aspect of California started early on with Los Angeles, with today's Silicon Valley, I think is rooted in this idea of California is a place for free thinkers to think outside the box. It started with the Bay Area and the Gold Rush. And then that particular region lent itself to bold, big visionaries who eventually gave rise to the internet even. So I think there's a spirit of California that has prevailed going back to the 19th century and that has really made it to a point where it's the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world. And so that has made California very important in regards to the United States and the world.
I don't often like to do crystal ball questions, but when I used to be in a history classroom, I talked to my students about why we learn history. There's always questions. I was a high school history teacher, so there's always questions, why are we learning about this? And part of the answer is that it helps you to understand your present, where you are and why you do the things you do, why your city is laid out the way it is. But it also can sometimes help you see where you're headed, because there's large movements that are pulling us forward. And by reading where we came from, we can gather a little bit about where we're going. So based on your research and your writing, where do you think LA is going?
Going in terms of what aspect?
In terms of its development, in terms of its future. I'm thinking about your book about freeways and thinking about the end of the freeway era and thinking about the limits to growth. At some point, are we going to think of the public transit expansion that's going on right now in Los Angeles? Is we can see that by looking at the way how challenging freeways were to develop in the Los Angeles area and how that's forcing the hands of civic leaders to rethink, like, how do we continue to develop into the future?
Yeah, we have certainly run out of land, and that's been an issue. So I think where we're going is connected to public transit. I think we're going to see more housing when it is built, and we need more housing clustered near these transit stations as we expand public transit and light rail and subways in LA. And I think we're going to go up also. We're going to see more vertical growth. The Los Angeles of my youth It was remained the same for about 100 years. There were very few skyscrapers in Los Angeles. There's probably double than when I was a kid. The Valley and Hollywood, they were all maybe 8, 10-story sized buildings would be the most you'd see. Now you're getting 20 to 30 stories high. It's going to look, Los Angeles in the future will look more like Eastern cities that have more congested or very concentrated areas of a lot of larger, taller buildings to accommodate more people. And I think it's gonna change the landscape, how we regard the city. We're gonna have more of an East Coast vibe, for lack of a better word. Yeah, because the freeways, those are just baked in. There's nothing we can do to decommission them or tear them down, but they'll just be complementary to the way we get around, which is gonna be largely more transit driven, people living more in city centers. And the last thing I would say also is you're gonna probably see more zoning changes. Areas that are zoned for single family housing. There's been movements afoot to try to get them to be zones rezoned for multi-family housing, apartments, things like that. I think that's going to be the next iteration we're going to see as well.
So you're seeing a YIMBY future, not a NIMBY future.
Well, NIMBY still to the people who live there who don't want it. But like it or not, it's going to be more YIMBYs than NIMBYs.
Okay. All right. We're going to close with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I have a series of books I cycle through for just, they're nonfiction books about Los Angeles that were great resources for inventing paradise, but also some that I turn back to because I just enjoy reading them. And one that I've turned back to recently because I love music and entertainment. I would say one of the best books about the music industry in relation to Los Angeles is called Waiting for the Sun. And it came out about 20, 25 years ago. But I just pulled it out again from my bookshelf and couldn't put it down. The full title is Waiting for the Sun, Strange Days, Weird Scenes, and the Sound of Los Angeles. And it's written by, I think he's a British guy, Barney Hoskins. And it really focuses a lot on the Laurel Canyon scene, Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Crosby, Stills and Nash, and up through the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt. And they're kind of this hub of people, these artists in the 60s and 70s who lived within Laurel Canyon, Frank Zappa, Mama Cass, the people who gave rise to the California sound. And there was something about the landscape and living on Laurel Canyon that allowed for this flourishing, burgeoning creative community, which really helped define rock and roll. And a lot of it was they had this great rambling community where they go to each other's houses and play and exchange ideas and then come down to the Sunset Strip at the bottom of the hill and play in the Whiskey A Go or the Troubadour and really hone their sound. And so it was a very fertile ground that this author, I feel, captures really well. That's just if you're looking at pop culture. As far as the history of LA, I would say one of the books that I really liked as a resource for inventing paradise was it's called Privileged Son. And it's the story of Otis Chandler and the rise and fall of the LA Times. Otis Chandler let's see, he would have been the great, great grandson of Harrison Gray Otis. So Otis Chandler, he ran the Times from 1960 up through the 90s. And by that point, the Times had become a progressive paper with a lot of Pulitzer Prize-winning articles and investigative journalism. But the book gets into the darker parts of the LA Times too, when it was more Republican paper and it was more about selling an agenda that wasn't necessarily news. And it has a lot of, it's a very juicy book with a lot of all the scandals of Otis Chandler's predecessors, including Harry Chandler and Harrison Gray Otis. That's a really good book called Privileged Son, Otis Chandler, and the Rise and Fall of the LA Times. And there's a number of good Mulholland books as well about William Mulholland. And my favorite is written by his granddaughter. She wrote a number of books about Mulholland and William Mulholland and the Rise of Los Angeles that's a must-read book. I would start with that for anyone who's trying to figure out how Los Angeles came to be. It's a good starting point. And that's by Catherine Mulholland.
I think the only one I've read is the one that's got angels in the name, Water to Angels, I think, or
Water the
something.
Angels is another one. Cadillac Desert is another one. However, I'd caution with that one. Some of the sources are a little iffy. I remember some things didn't really check out, but it's still a good book. With all these things, it's sometimes difficult to separate fact from fiction,
yeah.
But they're all very readable. And yes, there are other good books about William Mulholland as well.
Okay. Last question. What's your favorite movie about LA?
I have to go with Chinatown.
Okay. You're going to align with me on that. Sometimes yeah. I think of Lynch a little bit. His LA movies are fantastic. Speaking of Mulholland or Inland Empire or something like that. But yeah, I think Chinatown is one of the best. A lot of the noir from the early 50s is fantastic too. I'm thinking of, I can't even remember any of the names right now. There's so many good ones. It's hard to pick a movie about LA because it's self-referential in a lot of these movies.
Look, the Chandler books that were made into movies for sure.
The Big Sleep, all those.
Yeah, exactly. The 70s had a lot of good movies as well here. I like those movies that capture the essence of the grittiness of the 70s. If you want an obscure movie, Minnie and Moskowitz by John Cassavetes is a great movie that really captures that era of L.A. When it was smoggy and grimy. And Seymour Cassell and Jenna Rollins play these strange lovers in that movie. And it allows you to see LACMA, the LA County Museum of Art, when it was just built and there's a lot of water fountains around it. And they go to Pink's Hot Dogs and places that are still institutions today. We can see the old RTD buses, which are now MTA buses, chugging down Wilshire Boulevard. And it's shot along the streets of LA. So that's a fun one. Minnie and Moskowitz that I just saw recently that really captures that 70s of LA that I grew up with.
Yeah, I love Cassavetes' films. And I'm forgetting her name. She just passed away, right?
Jenna Rollins.
Yeah, Jenna Rollins just passed away.
That's why I just watched it again recently, I think.
Yeah, I just watched A Woman Under the Influence again recently for that reason. And I would say it's still a tough watch at times.
It's very difficult, but I'll tell you something about that movie, Jordan.
Yeah.
I watched it for the first time after, it would have been in the mid-90s, and I'd graduated from USC Film School. And it was a dark period of my life. I was trying to write screenplays. I wanted to write a great screenplay and direct it. And I was putting a lot of pressure on myself to break into the industry. I ended up working in television a few years later after I gave up my dreams of being the great American director. But as I was watching movies during that time, trying to inspire myself, I watched A Woman Under the Influence, which many people feel is John Cassavetes' best movie. It came out in 1974, and his wife in real life, and played in the movie by Jenna Rollins. She plays a woman who's undergoing a nervous breakdown or has mental health issues. And as I was watching the movie in my little ratty apartment in Hollywood on Taft Avenue, up the street from a 7-Eleven, which is still there, I started noticing, God, that looks really familiar, their house. And I realized that the house that they shot in for the movie where she lives was on my block. Taft Avenue.
Gosh.
Yeah, just north of that 7-Eleven. The house is still there. It looks the same from the movie. And not only was it the house used in the movie, it's the house that John Cassavetes lived in for a while with Jenna Rollins. They just shot it in their house. And there's parts of the movie where she waits for her kids to get off the school bus running along Hollywood Boulevard, which is Hollywood and Taft, just west of Wilton. And that kind of just gave me hope. It inspired me. Oh my God, they shot this on my street. And if he could do it, I can do anything. It was this strange beacon of hope at this time. That was a very difficult period in my life to know that my favorite filmmaker, John Cassavetes at that time, made his best movie a two-minute walk south of my apartment on the same street.
Yeah, I'll never forget that scene where she's waiting for her kids to get off the bus. It's just the way she moved her body. Anyway, we could talk about John Cassavetes forever. What are you working on next, Paul?
I'm exploring the next idea, to be honest. Whatever it is, it's going to be about how we got here, because I'm so interested in the journey of why did Los Angeles grow the way it did? What are the ripple effects on the city today? Trying to explain why the city is the way it is now, its boundaries, its neighborhoods, its way of life for people. It's all affected by these policies and decisions made decades ago. And I'm just so fascinated by that journey, whether it's freeways or generational wealth that excluded people of color. You can trace all this going back to decisions that were put into place or restrictive covenants from way back when. And so I'm trying to explore that theme again. Just I might focus on infrastructure again, might be something like freeways or major streets and the story behind them. Or I might focus on more the individuals like I did for this latest book, where I focused on this core of six oligarchs who gave rise to Los Angeles, or it might be a hybrid of the two. Again, I'm exploring those ideas.
Whatever it is, I'm going to be excited to read it because I absolutely have loved each of your books. They're fantastic. And I think writing about where we live is so important, just to understand who walked on the streets before us, who built those streets, why things are placed the way they are. It's never random. It's always for a reason. And I think that's an important part of why it's good to read local history in a lot of ways.
I agree with you. I think it makes us feel more connected to our communities and to the city. And it's important, I feel, to research and write these books to keep these past voices alive. And because the past goes away unless we resuscitate it from time to time and preserve it. And I feel like I'm in the business of preserving these important stories that explain the city today. And I'd like to continue doing that. So I think that's also of importance.
Thanks again, Paul. The book is called Inventing Paradise, The Power Brokers Who Created the Dream of Los Angeles. Thanks for talking with us today.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. ¶¶